Hello, I'm Peter Marshall, and in this BBC World Service programme, I'll be hearing about the inner workings of the so-called Islamic State, IS. It comes from someone with a unique insight. He's called Eamon Dean, and he's followed IS's transition from terrorist group into brutal but determinedly bureaucratic proto-state.
They have a department of the public good. And under the public good, everything from maintaining the roads, cleaning the streets, maintaining the street lightings, the provision of education.
So they run schools?
They run schools. And in fact, there are several professions that you cannot practice unless if you take a license from them. Being an imam of a mosque, being a teacher in a school, being a pharmacist, being a doctor, or being a lawyer. You need to attain a license from them, and you cannot get a license unless you attend a Sharia course for 1 week organized by them to indoctrinate you.
And that's why we've called this program Islamic State, Bureaucracy and Brutality. So how does Dean know so much about IS? Well, he has an extensive network of contacts, built up during the 12 years he himself spent inside the jihadist movement. After leaving school in Saudi Arabia back in the 1990s, Dean joined the Mujahideen in Bosnia. After the Balkan Wars, he moved on to the Philippines and then Afghanistan, where, in 1997, he joined Al-Qaeda. Eamon Dean says he soon became disillusioned by the drift towards terrorism. So Dean became a spy for the West.
Through many twists and turns, I found myself in the service of the British government at that time.
So you worked for the British Foreign Office?
Yes.
Can you tell what you were doing?
It was in the fields of information gathering and analysis.
And more than that, he won't say. The British Foreign Office, as you might expect, won't confirm or deny his story. But based on our own inquiries, we believe him. His impressions, he says, are based on deep inside knowledge. Despite the fact that Dean's now quite open about his opposition to the jihadist cause, there are those at the heart of the movement, within Islamic State, who still talk to him.
It's through debate. And through debate, you start to ask questions that lead them basically to reveal some of, at least, their thinking, some of their strategy. But since there is nothing confidential that will lead to a drone strike, let's say, or to an arrest, then it's fine. It is an ongoing discussion and dialogue.
So, over the next half hour, we find out how Islamic State attracts fighters, how it's managed to build and sustain itself economically, and why it may remain in power for some time to come.
In terms of recruits, in terms of firepower, in terms of financial resources, they are 100 times bigger than anywhere Al-Qaeda was.
One of the people Eamon Dean says he communicates with inside Islamic State is a childhood friend from Saudi Arabia. The friend's now a judge in an IS court. Dean and the judge talk using the online messaging system WhatsApp. From what Dean says, it appears to me that this friend, this judge, embodies the dual weapons of IS state control, bureaucracy and brutality.
He's only in his early 30s and he's very proud of the fact that he has passed over 34 sentences of lashes, of crucifixion, of beheading. And the fact that he is proud of it rather than feeling sorry for the victims in itself is an indication of a lust for a brutal authority that has been liberated by the fact of their interpretation of Islamic theology.
This is a friend of yours?
Indeed, yes.
How did he get involved in that?
Well, he was studying in university in Saudi Arabia, studying Sharia law. And in his third year, before he even finished, he decided to go and join the Islamic State.
Imposing these sentences and being proud of it, being quite thrilled to be in that position, he's been corrupted, presumably.
Yes, I mean, one of the things is a sense within jihadists, especially those who are within the Islamic State, I call it a sense of elitist isolationism. And it's that isolationist, elitist mentality which liberates the psychopath within. There are many people in this world who got that, small psychopathic tendency at the back of their mind. But it's the guilt and it is the conscience that basically stops them from hurting other people. However, if you tell someone that you will be able to behead, to kill, to lash, to burn villages, to do whatever you like, you know, while serving a cause, and you will be rewarded for it by God in the afterlife, it does wonders in terms of liberating the inner psychopath. And therefore, they don't see themselves as part of the world. They see themselves as a part of a new world, a purer world. For example, this judge, I was discussing with him a theological aspect of branding anyone who does not give them allegiance as an enemy or someone who is hostile. So I asked him a question. I said to him, are you telling me that, you know, 50 or 60,000 Muslims are right and the 1.5 billion Muslims are wrong? And his answer was quite chilling. He said, remember, God annihilated all of humanity for the sake of 12 believers with Noah. And he put them in the ark. And we are the ark. We are the ark of survival. So therefore, if all of humanity is to be annihilated for the sake of the truth, so be it. God did it. My answer to him was, you're not God.
What did he say to that?
He said, well, God did it as an example for us to follow.
This is terrifying, isn't it?
Indeed. Indeed it is terrifying because, you know, it means that even though they haven't exhibited mass murder yet on a scale that is similar to other regimes in the Middle East like Gaddafi or Assad or other dictators like Pol Pot or Stalin or Hitler or whatever, but nonetheless, it is a group that, because of their small resources, their massacres will be small right now. The question is, what if they have big resources in the future? What if actually they possess in the future workable chemical or even workable nuclear weapons? Will they use it? Of course, yes. If they are able to destroy dams in order to flood whole cities, they will do it. Especially the Shia cities like Karbala and Najaf, you know, they will do it.
The zealots of Islamic State are drawn to that apocalyptic vision. Like many Muslims, they believe the end of times, prophesied by Muhammad, would be preceded by major conflicts in certain parts of the world. Where these jihadists differ from mainstream Muslims is they want to hasten those end times. And using their frankly worrying metric, they're doing rather well. They've placed themselves at the centre of all the ancient predicted zones of conflict.
You have the prophecies talking about Afghanistan, prophecies talking about armies of jihad basing themselves in Yemen, in Iraq, in North Africa, and finally in Syria. And the prophecies make absolutely clear that Syria is the most important front in this struggle. So this is the crown jewel for jihadist movements. They want to be there because this is where the prophecies tell them to go. This is where the ultimate battle in order to establish the caliphate will take place. So their belief in it led many groups to prepare for that because they saw in the uprising there the hand of God paving the way for them to go into Syria, that they were waiting, and it happened. So therefore, the massive number of foreign fighters coming, and I had a chance to look at many of the notes the foreign fighters left to their families, whether in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in the UK here, talking about how this conflict is foretold by the Prophet Muhammad, that they are actually following the direction that the Prophet Muhammad has set for them 1400 years ago.
So they see the opportunity in Syria. They believe that this is the final fight. What happens then?
Well, the first thing is that they need to establish an Islamic State in a caliphate, and that's exactly what they did. This is where the split with Al-Qaeda happened.
So what are the roots of Islamic State? As with so much in the new, changing Middle East, they can be traced back to Iraq after the American invasion of 2003. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is a name we don't hear much of these days, but he led al-Qaeda in Iraq. His Sunni jihadist force deliberately fostered the worst of the sectarian strife which has riven Iraq over more than a decade. In 2006, a year after Zarqawi declared all-out war on the Shia, he was killed in a US bomb attack. But by then, the vital funding, the seed corn finance, which helped launch his campaign of violence and eventually Islamic State, had long been secured. And it came from the family of Saddam. As Eamon Dean tells it, hundreds of millions in cash, US dollars, was stolen from the Iraqi Central Bank by Saddam's son. But as he tried to flee the country, he was intercepted by Zarqawi's men. The militants used the money not to buy guns, but to turn themselves into apparently legitimate entrepreneurs.
They were buying existing businesses like cafes, restaurants, farms, butcher shops, tailor shops, and they were buying those that are conveniently located close to government headquarters and security headquarters. The purpose is for intelligence gathering and espionage, but also to recruit insiders.
Well, they actually planned this.
Yes, they did. Otherwise, how were they able in 2013 to plan and to perfectly execute a prison break in Abu Ghraib that resulted in 2,500 jihadists being freed from there? And then several other prison breaks all across Iraq, from Mosul all the way down to Ramadi. They freed thousands of jihadists.
But because they were based in the area, because they were based around the prison, because they were...
Around the prisons and around security headquarters and around the government headquarters, they were spying, they were recruiting insiders. You see, you can't take over a quarter of Iraq and one-third of Syria without having a proper, solid infrastructure that is both financial and intelligence.
That extensive business network now includes the oil fields we hear so much about on the news. These function in what's now Islamic State territory and produce oil for domestic use and for sale abroad on the black market. All this requires a huge number of professionals, people prepared to put themselves at the service of Islamic State. Not a problem, because after the toppling of Saddam Hussein, many of the secular Baathists who'd served him simply converted to the jihadist cause.
At the end of the day, this is all coming back to a fatal decision made by the new American administration in 2004 to dismiss the Iraqi army and to dismiss most of the Iraqi civil service. And also the parties that made the Iraqi government at that time in 2004 and 5 started to expel, you know, professors of economics and politics and planning and urban generation from universities because they were Baathist.
So the intelligentsia then had nowhere to go, and a lot of them would have joined these other groups.
Absolutely. Some of them would have joined because they need the money. They need protection also. And they need to do something. And therefore, when people say, how come they have this cadre of oil engineers, of financial planners, of business executives, it all boils down to the fatal decisions taken in 2003 and 4. By the new American administration and by the then Iraqi council.
The Baathists, Saddam's intelligentsia, are now key figures in Islamic State, helping to control a population of over 8.5 million. As they once followed Saddam, they're now ruled by a leader theologically required by Islamic State. The caliphate has a caliph. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, an Iraqi Islamic scholar claiming direct descendancy from the Prophet Muhammad, says he's born to the role. And in the world of jihadi militancy, he's always been connected. First, al-Baghdadi was reportedly the messenger between al-Qaeda in Iraq and Osama bin Laden. And then al-Baghdadi himself became the message. Last summer, 3 years after directing his Sunni fighters over the border into Syria, he declared himself leader of the Islamic world. There was now a caliphate. He was the caliph, leading a force far more powerful than al-Qaeda ever was.
Now Baghdadi talks of al-Qaeda. I mean, it almost dismisses them. It appears to be patronising about them.
Of course, because he sees them as people who had a goal but with no focus. And this is one of the things that I have commented on before, that the major differences between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State is that the Islamic State is focused. they are far more disciplined. They don't have, you know, franchises and cells here and there with greater autonomy. The Islamic State is focused on the region, that in order to have a state, you have to have a concentration of firepower and force within a certain region. And that the aim and the goal is to topple the Muslim regimes, and that the obsession with America is unhealthy.
So Islamic State has now pretty well overshadowed Al-Qaeda throughout the region.
Yes.
Al-Baghdadi is a leader whose brutality eclipses that of all his predecessors. But Ayman Dean says jihadists are eager to follow. 20,000 have come from way beyond Iraq and Syria.
From Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, Algeria, UK, France, Belgium, the US, Canada, Australia, basically everywhere.
And what's the point of getting the migrants to come and join?
Boosting the ranks. And to basically prove that it is an Islamic state. It is not a Syria state, it's not an Iraq state, it's not an Arab state, it is an Islamic state.
And who's doing the fighting in Syria?
Basically everyone who is under the allegiance of the Islamic State, from all nationalities. But the Iraqis and the Syrians make up the bulk, followed by the Saudis, the Tunisians, and to some extent there are many Egyptians also, and Turks. There are even Chinese Muslims.
Chinese Muslims?
Chinese Muslims, like, you know, there are hundreds of them there.
Coming from where?
Coming from Turkey. Turkey has accommodated almost 400,000 Chinese Muslims who fled from Xinjiang province since the 1950s. Still until now, many refugees are arriving in Turkey to seek refuge.
These are the Uyghurs, are they?
The Uyghurs, yes, indeed.
What's the attraction for them? It's this fulfillment of prophecies.
And furthermore, it is the fact that China is the largest investor in Iraqi oil. But most importantly, is to gain access to training and military experience.
To what end?
In order to take the jihad back to China.
So just China is presumably concerned about this as well?
Absolutely.
These migrants are important to IS, not just because they can serve as fighters and bureaucrats. They're a vital source of external funding through a system called Tajiz al-Ghazi.
The phrase Tajiz al-Ghazi means fitting out a soldier. Fitting out a soldier. This, in the past, it used to mean armor, shield, sword, lance, horse, you name it. Tajiz al-Ghazi is a system through which a group of people, let's say in here in the UK or France or any other community globally, know that there is an individual who wants to go to the jihad and join the Islamic State or any other jihadist group. They go and they give him money. So they give him $500, $600 each, amounting to about $2,500, $3,000. And this will be the money that he will use in order to reach his destination, buy a weapon, spend on himself in order to join the jihad. And it used to be done by those who has the means to those who don't have the means in order to go and fight. Or it's done by women who can't go and fight their own jihad. There are those who are disabled. There are those who have got businesses to run. So all of these people contribute in order for these people to go. And that system sustained many jihadist theaters all across the world for the past three decades. It sustained them. Why? Because every jihadist who is about to leave from any community across the world, there will be people who know about the fact that he is going. So on top of the tajhiz money they gave him, they will give him other donations, up to $10,000. And they are prohibited from carrying more than that. Otherwise, they will have to declare it. Once they arrive there, they hand over the money to the commanders. Now, imagine that if 1,000 people comes to Syria every month, and each one comes with $10,000, that's $10 million. Within 1 year is $120 million. It is a system where you minimize the risk, you minimize the possibility of interception, and you are financed throughout the year by these new recruits.
And the people who are giving this money, do they know what's happening to it?
In many cases, yes. In some cases, no. In many cases, they know. Because they believe in the cause. And this is their justification. They will say, well, the average British and American and Australian taxpayers basically are funding the military effort of their governments through the taxation. So basically, since the jihad effort is funding it is part of the zakat system, which is the religious taxation in Islam, therefore it is, according to their own interpretation and their own belief, it is their duty then to fund the military effort of the Islamic State.
So that's one important revenue stream.
Absolutely. You go then into the charities and their role. In the past, obviously, the majority of Muslim charities are doing a fantastic job in terms of providing for those who are desperately in need of help. However, there are certain charities, smaller charities, their activities are legitimate as far as the one can see from afar. However, if you examine, you will see that there is what I call an indirect funding. Indirect funding is a method by which many smaller, purposely established entities, disguised as charities, are employing in order to bypass the illegality of providing financial aid to terrorist groups. How? Part of any groups like the Islamic State, part of their expenses, and it's a heavy burden on them, will be the welfare payments for the families, widows and orphans of deceased fighters. And they end up with thousands of families who are expecting to be looked after, given that their husbands and sons and brothers gave the ultimate sacrifice and fought for the group. Therefore, they always look for charities from all over the world who are sympathetic and who know what's going on to basically take care of these families, to actually take them into their own books. And this way, the money that was allocated towards these families will be diverted towards military means because someone else took care of their food, fuel, medication costs.
So these humanitarian donations, you're saying, are again a problem?
Yes.
It's been remarkable the speed with which ISIS has managed to sweep through large parts of Syria and Iraq, taking and holding territory, establishing something resembling a state. As we heard earlier, the rapid rise of IS is due in part to the fact that the group had an extensive network of business people working covertly for it in Iraq. According to Eamon Dean, a similar network now exists beyond IS's boundaries.
The Islamic State established several entities in Turkey in order to import hospital beds, antibiotics, pharmaceuticals, surgery equipments, in order to provide their fighters and to some extent the population there with health services.
Established in Turkey?
There are many sympathetic communities in Turkey and to some extent even within Jordan and the KRG. All you have to do is phone one of those sympathizers with clean record to establish an export and import operation in Turkey and to start importing. They can import a significant amount of food items that are not available readily in Syria or Iraq. They can import electronics, computers, laptops.
All that's happening?
Yes, it is. It's been happening for the past 6 months at least.
The Turkish government seemed to be rather ineffectual in combating ISIS.
In a sense, yes, but it is easy to ask the Turks to combat ISIS, yet no one is going to rescue Turkey when Turkey is faced with the consequences of dismantling ISIS finances. ISIS could easily wage a terror campaign in Turkey that would affect adversely the tourism industry, and the Turkish economy would face a free fall.
But then, say Assad goes, ISIS takes over, Turkey then will be even more vulnerable.
Yes, indeed. However, they feel that there is nothing that can be done right now without considerable harm done to Turkey. You put yourself in their shoes. What would you do?
What would you do?
Well, in my case, basically, I will just turn a blind eye and pray for the best.
Which is what's happening at the moment.
Absolutely.
You may well ask how Islamic State pays for its cars and laptops and pharmaceuticals, all imported goods. In the early days, hoards of gold they'd seized were the source of foreign exchange. But in the past year, foreign gold traders became wary of buying anything that might be from Islamic State. So IS, gold rich but cash poor, came up with another use for the gold. They made a mint. They produced their own solid gold coins.
I remember when it was announced by the treasury, basically, of ISIS, there was some derision in the Western press about it as a gimmick and as a meaningless gesture. However, it is not. Why? because it's a symbol of hegemony, it's a symbol of authority, it's a symbol of legitimacy, but also at the same time it is an important money-making scheme for them.
And you can see this happening, what, by the end of the year?
I would say by mid-2015, it would have been more or less became the norm to see ISIS coins.
The final irony is that much of the gold for IS's currency will have been looted from churches. Some of Syria's expert goldsmiths, Armenian Christians, are now said to be at the service of Islamic State, minting the coins. And that more or less sums up how Islamic State is sustained day by day. Those of the population not enthralled to notions of end times jihadism are co-opted or coerced. Aside from the stonings, the beheadings, and variously sanctioned cruelties of this state, its existence still rests on religion, on belief. It's theologically driven. And it's on this ground that Eamon Dean maintains the zealots must eventually be tackled.
How are they going to be beaten?
We need to discredit them ideologically and theologically, but if people keep focusing on the military front and forgetting that there is a battle of theological narrative there to be won, and not only in Arabic, but in English and French and German and other languages, even Chinese, then I don't see any hope for this campaign. It will just be dropping bombs on ISIS, killing 7 today, only for 14 of them to replace them tomorrow.
That's all from this special BBC World Service programme for today. I'm Peter Marshall, and I was talking to Eamon Dean. The producer was Innes Bowen.